You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Well, it looks like it's Danny Bessner and Derek Davison of the American Prestige Podcast, and I'm Robert Wright, which can mean only one thing. It's another high synergy, collaborative episode of two podcasts.
Two brilliant podcasts who are catching all of the subscribers who are leaving the left liberal podcast sphere, as has been tweeted out recently. Yeah.
That's kind of interesting, actually.
That's
discredited, right? And they're all heading our way. By the way, where do I fit on that spectrum? I mean, you guys are obviously like far left, you know, radicals, but what am I?
Only in the American context.
Oh, I'm a progressive realist. I forgot. You're
a Sigma. Do you know what a Sigma is? I'm sure you know what an Alpha is. A Sigma is someone who is so Alpha that they are effectively outside of the system. And I think that's Bob Wright.
That sounds like me. I had not heard the term, but it just feels so natural for me to wear it.
You should get like a Sigma branded non-zero merchandise. I think that would do really well.
Totally. You guys are my inspiration, as always, in this, in marketing, as in other things. So, you guys having a good time? The first week of the Trump administration has been eventful, I would say.
Yeah, at least in terms of appointments. It's very similar to what he did last time. Yeah, you know, a lot of weird appointments at first, and then the question is, how long will they last? Michael Flynn, I think, was the shortest serving national security advisor in history, something like 21 days. Yeah, something like that. And so, you know, the degree to which these people are going to be able to manipulate the bureaucracy, work within these very powerful and entrenched institutions, it's very much an open question. Like, how is Elon Musk going to deal with, for example, a bureaucracy that wants nothing to do with him? You need some sort of skill and ability to deal with people, which I'm not sure Dr. Musk has. Maybe I'm a less garment rending about this than a lot of people I read online, but that to me really does remain an open question, to what degree they'll be able to actually use the state, which is not an easy institution to manipulate.
Yeah, I don't think he's actually planning to have any personal encounters with these people. I think he's just planning to draw X's across the names of agencies and hand the paper to Trump.
Yeah, that's not going to do anything, though, right? Like, that's not an effective way to actually exert power in the extant American state. So
I don't know what kind of power they have. I'm sure Trump will push the envelope, and some of this stuff may wind up in the courts. But I'm not that conversant. I do think the relationship between Trump and Musk may last longer than some people are saying. I mean, you know, Trump has parted ways abruptly with a lot of people, but Musk has a lot of things to bring to Trump, like mass following that he can mobilize. He runs a social media platform. He can donate to the midterms and help ensure Trump continued control of Congress and so on. You know,
those last three are big. What is this? What do you mean by mass following? I mean, I see like
all the Elon stands. I mean, all the fanboys. There's a ton of Elon fanboys.
How mass is that?
I believe it may have been mass enough. I think it was a significant effect because I imagine these guys as the kind who probably many of them weren't all that highly motivated to vote. And they're like vaguely, yeah, Trump seems like interesting, fine. And Elon says, hey, then why don't you get out and vote for him? But I don't know how big the following is, but, you know, first of all, he has a kind of ardent, at least they speak highly of him, following of elites, Silicon Valley elites, right? Nobody wants to speak ill of him in Silicon Valley.
That's a true power block for sure. That's the true power block.
You know, why is his stock so much more highly priced than the fundamentals would seem to validate? You know,
the whole economy is bullshit, Bob.
What's that?
You know that the whole economy is. Look at the market capitalization of the top five firms. It's like 50 times what they actually bring in a year. This is my big take about the economy.
Tesla's off the charts. Yeah. If you look at like, you know, revenue and earnings.
Well, it's all off the charts. Like, look at what Amazon or Meta are valued at. The market capitalizations are like giant compared to what they actually make. The whole economy is basically premised on several monopoly plays that are supposed to basically just dominate everything. We're a totally financialized economy and it's all fake. So I'm not sure that is.
I was wondering how long it would take to get to that sermon.
It's true. It's not a sermon. It's a fact.
Yeah, but it's a little too sweeping for present purposes, I think, because it's only a subset of the economic actors who are a problem right now. I mean,
well, they have real money. I mean, it's just the economy is based on air. I mean, the contradiction is.
I mean, the economy is not based on air. People buy real products and get real services. What do you mean?
Yes, but the valuations of what the value that these companies are actually producing do not relate to their actual market capitalization.
Well, anyway, whatever they're at, Tesla goes to 11, okay? I'm telling you, it's relative to the valuation of other comparable corporations. It's way the hell out there. Anyway,
I would never take on a Sigma.
I'm kicking myself for not investing in Bitcoin because it shot up after the election. Speaking of things that are resting on air, boy, did that boom after the election.
Yeah, there's going to be some carnage eventually there, I think. But who knows? I mean, here's a question. Before we get to the many other things we could talk about, including some, national security and foreign policy related picks, cabinet picks. Is Elon, look, I'm not naive. Obviously, money has played a disconcerting role in politics for a long time and a growing role, I would say. But isn't Elon the closest thing to a true oligarch we've had?
Since when? Like, are you talking in the last?
Well, just
like,
name another one.
J.P. Morgan.
For the last, I don't know what Morgan. What
John
kind
D.
Of
Rockefeller.
I mean, but were even they like part of the
Andrew
administration
Carnegie.
And
yes.
Vital?
Who was the one who became like the secretary? Like, who was the? There's one. I think it's Morgan in the 20s. The banker basically ran the economy. Like during the Republican hegemony of the 1920s, you basically have bankers running economies through the things like the Dawes Plan and the Young Plan. And I would say, as of yet, it could change, but like Musk does not approach the level of power.
Okay,
like
so we'll confine it to the last century, more or less. Now, how is my...
it's a good question. Let me think. I mean, I think the state did, to some degree, the New Deal Fordist state did limit the power of those oligarchs. And one of the reasons for the creation of the New Deal state was that. None are immediately coming to mind. I'm trying to think. Derek, maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong.
I object to the use of the word oligarch, which only applies in the Russian and Eastern Bloc case.
Because only they are bad.
Yeah, exactly. It should never be applied to the West.
I agree. We're not bad. That would never happen here. There would never be... Money would never influence events here.
No, I mean, come on. We're
this is democracy.
Petty concerns. Yeah.
Democracy. Liberal, democratic country.
I've snapped out of it. Thank you. I feel better now.
But I do think we have to wait to what degree he's actually able to exert power. I mean, if you do look back on the way someone like J.P. Morgan was able to exert power, it's very direct and very important. And Musk has not indicated that he's able to do that yet. What he has been very good is using government resources to basically make SpaceX combat NASA as the center of space policy. That has been very much correct. But to what degree he's able to push the government in certain directions, I think just remains an open question. He very well may be able to.
The variety of assets he can bring on the one hand and the variety of interests he has in the government on the other. So he's got the social media platform. He's got tons of money to donate. He's got the aforementioned fan base. He can bring a lot of things. And for that matter, I mean, Starlink is this important asset. He could take it away from nations if he wanted to, you know. And then and by the same token, he's got all of these interests in government, right? These contracts with different agencies. And now they're giving him this power, nominally at least, to punish specific agencies that he thinks haven't treated him well, which he believes about a lot of them because he's been subject to a lot of regulations. He doesn't, I mean, it's really an amazing combination in terms of the number of dimensions and the magnitude, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly worrying, something to keep an eye on. I mean, I just fundamentally skeptical he's going to actually be able to use state power. I think that people who have no experience using state power traditionally aren't very good at using it. And you have to have a certain type of political cast of minds to do things like manipulate bureaucracies. It's very different from Silicon Valley, where you're able to sort of great man yourself into power. So, I mean, that's my take on it, which I could be wrong. You know, that's just a prediction of what's going to happen. It just doesn't seem like someone is going to be able to do that particularly well. The ego, the sort of self-importance, the narcissism is not... lend itself to manipulating these types of institutions.
He's not subtle. So I don't know what else. So Derek, you pretty pleased with the apparent direction of our foreign policy under Trump?
It's amazing. I mean, it's like watching Danny and I just said this on our news episode. It's like watching the Justice League come together. Like all the superstars, Marco Rubio, Pete Hegseth, the Fox and Friends guy. I mean,
Tulsi.
It's just Tulsi.
Tulsi back.
Elise Stefanik. Yeah.
Well, Tulsi, actually,
all the greats.
I was going to ask you about Tulsi. Do you consider her, like, seriously, like, the best thing there? I mean, you know, she is the, I mean, the restrainers generally, a lot of restrainers who are disappointed, and I don't know when these people will learn about Trump. I mean, I wouldn't have gotten my hopes up in the first place.
That's amazing. Like, yeah, you went through this once already. Like, why are you still investing any hopes in this guy? Yeah.
But when they got to Tulsi, some of them were like, yeah, okay, there you go. She'll help.
No,
I mean, ideologically, she's more restraint-oriented than any of his other picks. But she's also being stuck in, you know, like the DNI is not a powerful position. It was envisioned as superior to the director of the CIA and like sitting at the apex of the intelligence community. But it's really like an administrative job. At this point, like it's
right, she doesn't have many independent intelligence assets, right?
Right.
Like, can she even generate like a counter-conventional wisdom report about what the Chinese regime wants? Does she even have an assistant she can have do that? I mean,
I don't think so. I mean, I mean, they can compile from agency. Like that's the whole point of the office is to sort of, you know, kind of bring together all these different intelligence agencies and synthesize. Reporting from them, but I don't think they have a lot of independent intelligence gathering capability.
You'd have to carve it out. You'd have to basically make deals with other organizations. And I do want to self-correct myself. It was Andrew Mellon I was thinking of, not Morgan. I got my M's mixed up. Just to be clear. But back to Tulsi. I mean, it would have to be basically a bureaucratic genius in some regards to exert power. And that's, I think, going to be the nature of the administration. And this is the nature of presidential administrations throughout American history. Basically, when you come in, Derek and Bob, as I'm sure you know, you kind of recreate the institutional structure of the executive foreign policy making. You could do it in any way you effectively want to. And you could listen to some people, not listen to others. Famously, Franklin Delano Roosevelt barely listened to his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like personnel is policy sometimes and not other times. And Trump is so erratic. And he's now older and more erratic that I think it's just very difficult to make any genuine prediction about what is going to happen. And I think it's very difficult to make a personnel as policy argument with him because he's so strange.
Yeah, it's hard to say which way to go. I mean, on the other hand, there's a certain aspect of this that was completely predictable, I think, which is we got a bunch of people who are basically, with few exceptions, Iran hawks and China hawks. That you kind of knew what was happening, just based on his constituency, his donor base and everything. I think that was baked in. And I mean, that's the funny thing. That's the other funny thing about taking Trump seriously as a restrainer. Well, it's true he may wind down the Ukraine war, which looks kind of like inevitably it's about to happen one way or the other anyway. But if you look at the two most worrisome parts of the world right now in terms of, you know, how flammable they are, the prospects for American conflict, they're like China and Iran, and Trump is as hawkish and crazy as it gets. So I do not get the high hopes that have now obviously been dashed in the conservative restrainer community for Trump.
The hope is in the erraticism, I think. The hope is that he'll randomly make a decision, right? Where Derek and I talked a little bit about this before the election, like Harris was just going to continue the Israel thing, and Trump is almost certainly likely to do that too. Don't get me wrong, but there's a world where he sees a picture and changes things, right? Like that's just the erraticism of him that I think is what people are placing their hopes in. It's not a great hope, but that's what I think they're doing.
There is a world, but first of all, I think Israel's definitely not that world. I think that's where you're going to see him green light the annexation of the West Bank and whatever in Gaza, possibly.
Totally agree.
You know, the ethnic cleansing and annexation of it. That's just going to, I don't see that getting anything but uglier. I think Trump is just going to encourage Bibi to get the ugliness over before late January. But And in China, you're right, though. It is true that Trump could be seized at any moment, you know, and say, like, wait, why don't I be the person who made peace with Iran or China? But then he's like so deluded, right? Like, I think.
Yes. also true.
Like, didn't he say he was going to get Iran to join the Abraham Accords or something? Who floated that? Like, that would be quite the pivot, you know, for Iran to recognize Israel tomorrow. But I agree. And on China, too. I'm sure he'll have these days where he'll say, wait, why don't I be Kissinger this time? There's an answer to that, Donald, but go ahead. Good luck.
Yeah, I mean, like, could he have a Trump goes to China equivalent? You know, obviously the reference to Nixon goes to China. Maybe. Yeah. There's a possibility, but it's nothing to rely on, right? And this is what I think you'll see very similar to what you saw last time, which is a system running basically with no one at its helm, kind of like Bob, you love AI. I know you're a big fan of AI. I can't wait for it to come. Skynet has become self-aware.
It's a love-hate relationship, but I definitely think its importance is being underrated. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, like, Skynet could just have been self-aware, and it's just going to go regardless of who's at the helm. And I think that's what I would imagine is going to happen with
that's
Trump.
A lot of things are on rails.
Yeah.
Skynet reaches down and plucks Trump out of the Oval Office. Yes.
So, I think you'll see a lot of the same, you know, without the liberal internationalist rhetoric. One thing that is, I think, going to be true is, and we were just talking about this on our podcast, I think the Biden foreign policy team is going to go down as one of the worst in history, like one of the absolute worst in modern history, which is kind of like obviously getting their just desserts, Jake Sullivan, Antony Blinken, people who fancy themselves the wise men. I think they just were terrible. And that's like a nice little consolation prize.
They didn't even take advantage of their chance to just like slap Bibi on the way out by following through on this threat to punish Israel if they didn't improve the aid situation in Gaza. You know, Obama did take advantage of a comparable period to like piss off Bibi by not vetoing something at the Security Council, but apparently Biden's not going to do that.
Okay.
But, very brave of him.
Let's be real about what's going to happen to these people. They're all going to they're all going to sit on corporate boards. They're going to get, you know, appointments, sinecure appointments at think tanks. They're going to go open their own strategic consultancies or join the ones they were in, like WestExec, and make gobs and gobs of money. There's no consequence here for them.
You mean other than Sullivan and Blinken and those guys?
Yeah. Other than, like, history will look unkindly on them, which, okay, I do they care? I mean, do you care at that point if you're going to get, if you're going to make, more money than you can ever spend in your lifetime now as you cash out after being a total failure? Like, does it matter?
So you don't think they woke up this morning worrying about what we would say about them? Is that what you're saying?
I don't. I really don't think so. Shocking. Maybe, you know, on an edge case or two, but for the most part, no, I don't think they did.
I think they've made it very unlikely that they will ever serve in a Democratic administration again. And I'm sure Jake Sullivan going into the Biden thing was thinking next time Secretary of State or something. And he did have those kinds of aspirations. I don't know how materially motivated they are. You know, there's people in Washington who actually don't care that much about money. They want influence. They want power. They want responsibility and some, and they all convince themselves they want to do good. We all convince ourselves of that. So I'm not sure they didn't have aspirations that I suspect will be thwarted. I just think they will be sufficiently tainted by this that even though it's a minority part of the Democratic coalition that gives a shit, it's a part that really gives a shit. And it's like, why annoy them further? You know,
and they weren't that good at the job. I mean, just flat out, they didn't do a good job.
We agree on that. Yeah, leaving aside the genocide and the moral aspect of it, they're just bad. They've just been bad at the job. Like the basic.
They're amateurs. They're amateurs. That's the funny thing.
But I mean, I've been on this kick since the election. Like, there's no consequence, and I mean, this is true. And you know, once you hit a certain level in American society in general, but it seems especially relevant to the Democratic Party and its appendages. There's no consequence for failure. There's no consequence for losing an election, even if it's the most important election of our lives, as the last, you know, 25 elections have been. There's no consequence for being, you know, on MSNBC and running, you know, Dear Leaders propaganda 24/7, and then, you know, going through this election where you get absolutely rinsed and you know, should be completely discredited. There's no accountability for any of that, because nobody ever fails once they hit the status of being, you know, a top consultant in the party or top campaign operative or any of these roles, you know, foreign policy or, you know, being an anchor or a host on cable news. You just never, it never redounds when you're manifestly like not doing a good job or you fail in any way.
Actually, sometimes you get promoted. Jeffrey Goldberg, example, helped get us into the Iraq War, and they made him head of the Atlantic. So things happen, there are consequences. It is so simplistic to say there aren't consequences, Derek. You get a pay raise and a promotion.
That's true. Yeah,
John Chait, who just moved to the Atlantic after getting everything wrong.
They should stick all of those people at the Atlantic and then, like, run the first like manned mission to Mars and just stay there and write their magazine for themselves on Mars.
I know, John, and although I haven't talked to him in years, I assume we're still on good terms. So I would just like to disassociate myself from all of your remarks. However, I'm sure they'll be entertaining. So continue.
Well, Bob, I wanted, like, you swim amongst these people in a way that neither Derek and I do. What is the state of resistance liberalism? It seems much, much more muted than last time. I mean, I was joking about all these people leaving Twitter. It's like they got demoted from the MLB and they're now in AAA on Blue Sky. There's like a moment of stepping back. So I'm just curious, like, it seems like not like last time, much more muted, much less vim and vigor behind any resistance activity. I'm just curious what you've seen in your own anecdotal life and then more generally.
Well, I like to think that some people have recognized that an overly reactive approach last time around actually helped Trump. You know, a little known fact is that my newsletter, the Non-Zero newsletter, was started in 2017, and it was called Mindful Resistance. I had just published a book about Buddhism and mindfulness, but the point was the resistance needs to be less reactive, more calm and considered. And I'm like kind of renewing that line now in my newsletter to some extent, because I think it's still true. You have to be careful. But I like to think that some of what you're talking about does reflect a recognition that we so often played into his hands by freaking out about everything he says when his base looks at what he says and like just uses our reaction to confirm that we're crazy and we're the enemy, because he's such a master at saying these things that are Rorschach tests, right? You know, like the thing about Liz Cheney is like, if she likes war so much, she should go to war. And then he throws in the part about shooting her in the face. Like, the basic upshot of it makes sense, right? We've all said this. If Bill Kristol likes war so much, he should go fight him. We've all said this. But then he throws in this graphic part that freaks everybody on our side out. He does this all the time. So anyway, I'm hoping...
Yeah, because he fucks with people. Like, that's his shtick. He fucks with people. Just like he fucked with the Manhattan elite when he was an outer borough guy going to New York in the 70s and the 80s. It's his entire vibe. But it does seem like people are less freaked out about it, I guess is what I'm saying. Well, are not taking it... Please, tell me I'm wrong.
Well, I just think the round of appointments, maybe we can get to that, started, a couple of them freaked people out. The two leading freaker outers were probably Matt Gaetz and I think maybe Pete Hegseth at the Secretary of Defense. He freaks me out. You know, he defended, he's the guy who got Trump to lessen the punishment given to that Gallagher guy, the Navy SEAL, who just savagely murdered this POW. And his fellow SEALs wanted him brought to justice. They testified to it, but then they pulled a fast one in court and got him off the hook on that charge. And he just got a slap on the wrist for having his picture taken with a corpse or something. And I grew up in a military family. I'm kind of sensitive about this. Like, you know, there were respectable people in the military, including my father. It's an institution that at that point had actual values. And I think it still does to a large extent. But if we're going to have a Secretary of Defense, with that kind of philosophy, like, you know, hey, war is hell, so kill the Muslims. You know, I see only bad things.
Well, it is quite interesting, because one of the great story of the military over the course of the 20th century was its professionalization, going back to Elihu Root in the early part of the 20th century, which is that you're not going to have that type of thing. You're going to have a capital P progressive military. It's going to be filled with experts who like technology and who are forward-looking and who abide by a professional code of ethics, much like was happening in journalism at a similar time. That's what's really interesting, because I do believe the military itself, the people who run it for the most part, are mega professional. We don't have any Caesars, though. We don't have any Pompeys, mega charismatic generals. We had David Petraeus and Wesley Clark, some of the least charismatic people of all time, because they went through that professionalization process. But the new SecDef is very much not that, right? So it's going to be sort of this old type of charismatic guy up against a mega professionalized institutional bureaucracy. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with it. I mean, I will come down again on the side of the institutional bureaucracy is just so, so powerful that it is probably going to limit the damage that someone like that could do, but that could always be wrong.
Well, Trump is already saying he wants to purge.
He's going to get rid of the woke generals.
He's going to get rid of the woke generals.
He's going to fire... the thing I saw is he's going to fire anybody who was promoted by Mark Milley. So anybody connected to him or perceived as connected to him, which includes C.Q. Brown, the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and a lot of other people in the Joint Chiefs, at the very least, are going to get...
But there's going to be a second filter. He's going to select for what he perceives as personal loyalty to Trump. I mean, that's what he wants at the top of the military hierarchy. And that could get a little scary if we do reach a moment where, and I don't think it's impossible now. I mean, I was not, like last time around, I wasn't doing the David Frum thing of you know, writing about creeping authoritarianism every week. But now that Trump knows what he's doing, and after we've seen how what he did after the 2020 election, you know, it's
what
worth
failed to
about.
Stop the certification. I mean, I am a lone wolf on this, but I do not. I am not so bothered and upset by January 6th. It was obviously not a great instance of mob violence, but this was not on the path to a coup. You needed to have a plan. How is he actually going to seize state power? It was a semi-random attempt to stop the certification of an election. That is not similar to what the Soviets, fascists, or Nazis did in any way, shape, or form. So obviously it's disqualifying because it doesn't abide by the liberal norms, but I thought of many things that Trump did before that was disqualifying. This totemic role that January 6th plays to me is a bit, I don't know, strange. It doesn't really line up with the evidence, but Bob, tell me where I'm wrong.
It made his aspirations clear. He clearly would be willing to completely subvert the Constitution. You saw that both in the way he was trying to manipulate the results when he called the Georgia Secretary of State and pressured him to go find votes that weren't there. And in the middle, I mean, remember, in the middle of January 6th, he's watching it on TV. He knows they're inside the Capitol. He knows they already hate Mike Pence. And Mike Pence is in the Capitol, and he tweets something. I forget the wording, but it's like calling him a traitor or something. I mean, and of course, the process he was trying to disrupt was kind of an important one, the peaceful transfer of power. But, you know, he was willing to see Mike Pence lynched, you know, and it was the aspiration that was revealed. And this time around, he has a better idea of what he's doing. And again, you look at a number of these appointments, particularly Hegseth and Gates, I would say. And unlike last time around, he's immediately trying to fill these slots with people who are aligned with his vision and, so far as I can tell, completely amoral. And that's, you know, it's a combination of aspiration and what he's done so far. I'm not saying it's likely. I'm saying it's worth worrying. It's worth hoping that he doesn't succeed in bringing a bunch of loyalist generals to the top of the military hierarchy, because in a certain kind of situation, he could exploit that to the detriment of the Republic.
Yeah, that is true. And then, of course, the factor is to what degree are they going to be able to manipulate these institutions? And maybe I'm just too focused on, I basically study the history of American political development, which is the history of the American state. It's just an incredibly large institution with matrices of power centers that is actually incredibly difficult to push in your direction. And I would say, just like, I'm saying this, Trump might be able, might be unable to manipulate it. I would say it probably would have also been difficult for someone like Bernie Sanders to push it in a different direction as well, without really having a great strategic map in the old Union sense of where power actually lies. It's an incredibly difficult thing to push in any direction, good or bad. And I guess that's my, calming salve when I'm thinking about the future of the Trump administration. He, to me, does not seem like someone who's going to have a great strategic map about how to move the ship of state in a particular way.
Yeah, I'm feeling better already. Derek, are you not, are you unconcerned about the authoritarian prospect?
I'm not, it's not at the forefront of my mind. I think the possibility exists that, he will take steps during his presidency to get around any sort of opposition. Like people talked about already that he might adjourn Congress and, appoint all these people through recess appointments. If he thinks that, like Gates, for example, who's the one that really seems to be like generating, are you kidding me, reactions even from Republicans. Mm-hmm. So I think he'll exert whatever or pull whatever levers he can, which are a number of levers. I mean, I think one of the things that we've learned or should have learned over the last quarter century is that the Constitution of the United States doesn't really put a lot of roadblocks in the way of somebody who just wants to break things and do what he wants. It's all dependent on people of goodwill, acting in responsible ways. And we don't have that. That doesn't work in this environment. So I do think there's a lot of that. In terms of, like, is he going to try to extend his time in office, or, are we going to have another January 6th, except this time, I don't know what the context of that would be, because it's not like he's going to lose an election. He's going to be term limited out of office. Like, what is he going to do about that? I'm less concerned about that, maybe because it's 4 years down the road and, who knows where we'll be at that point. But also, I'm not sure that he wants to be president. I don't think he wants to be president at a fundamental level. Like, he wanted to win again, to salve his ego. So that he could go out on top. But I don't get the sense that this is somebody who's particularly happy in the job, or would like to continue it, beyond what his limits are. I don't know. Maybe he'll decide otherwise, but it's not a huge concern, although I'm not as sanguine about it, I guess, as Danny is,
it's not only a complete, like, takeover kind of thing that I'm worried about. I'm worried about, like, in a period of disorder. I mean, say the mass deportations produce protests, and then there are counter protests from Team Red.
But even with the mass deportations, Bob, like, there's such a significant portion of the Republican Party that can't do that, that they cannot do the mass deportations because it will undercut their entire business. We just did a whole special about this, right? Like, this is why E-Verify has not been a thing. It's very easy to do these sorts of things, but there's a very important fraction of the Republican Party.
If Trump is rounding up people, which he has the legal authority to do, who stops him? Like, somebody who runs a business in Des Moines says, wait a second, I was hiring some of these people. How does it happen?
It would be a fraction of the Republican Party that is going to go up against Stephen Miller. The representatives within Trump's own administration, plus the fact that ICE is 21,000 people and he'd have to do a massive expansion of ICE to actually do these things. There's just like gigantic structural impediments, both politically and just literally. So, I mean, like, just to say, well, as he begins his deportations, I think actually takes us out of the actual political problem that someone like Trump is going to have to face if he wants to deport 15 million people, right? This is extraordinarily difficult thing to do, not only because ICE isn't large enough to do it and you'd have to create all these new sorts of institutions, but also because lots of Republicans don't want him to do it.
Yeah, I'm not saying he'd get them all deported. I was just conjuring up a scenario where he's deporting like enough that you get demonstrations, you get counter demonstrations. There are guns involved. There's violence, and he nationalizes the National Guard or does something else and just sets a disturbing precedent and exerts a degree of kind of a military force domestically that's unprecedented. And then who knows where things go from there. But that's just a bad, probably not a good place. Who knows?
I agree with that, Bob. I mean, I think there is a high likelihood of some of things like that happening, like you deploying the military on domestically to deal with protests or to deal with the border or to deal with, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, particularly if he's going to try to do the mass deportations, and I don't even know that he's going to, that this is going to be anything more than like a demonstration. But if he actually tries to deport millions of people, he's going to have to, as Danny just said, you know, DHS doesn't have the capacity for that. Just he's going to have to turn to the Pentagon to do it, mm-hmm. in which case you have American soldiers in the streets like rounding people up. And I don't put that past him. I mean, it's sort of a, I'm not sure that that's what he's going to do.
He could also nationalize the National Guard, right? That's a lot of people.
Right. Yeah. And, I mean, to deploy even the National Guard, which is going to be in uniform with military-esque hardware in that capacity would be a shocking thing.
Did you see the statement he put out about maybe wanting a state of emergency? He's sounding like he would ask Congress for it. But did you read the statement? It's kind of hilarious just because for some reason they decided to write it as if it were the 18th century. I mean, it's the language. Oh, God. It starts, "It is to be hoped that the normal balance of executive and legislative authority may be wholly adequate to meet the unprecedented task before us. But it may be that blah, blah, blah." And then he gets down. "I am prepared under my constitutional duty to recommend the measures that a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world may require." He goes on, "these measures or such measures as the," I mean, it reads like the Constitution. These measures "or such other measures as Congress may build out of its experience and wisdom, I shall seek within my constitutional authority to bring to speedy adoption." Donald Trump does not talk this way. Okay.
Did they write this on parchment with like the big swooping S's and all that?
I think we're talking ChatGPT. I think we're talking ChatGPT.
Maybe.
And then what are the final stirring lines? "Oh, for the trust reposed in me, I shall return the courage and the devotion that befit the time. I can do no less." That is the solemn ending. And in the middle there, he says, "I shall ask Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis. Broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency." He never defines what the emergency is, but he's already talking this way.
So then here's the counter. Why didn't he do it in the first term?
Yeah, but see, I think that's the question he's addressing. Everybody says that to him. "You didn't even get the fucking wall built." And he's like, "I'll show him."
It took Joe Biden to do that.
"I'll show him." What?
It took Joe Biden to do that. I think we're assuming this guy is a political genius and nothing in the entire history of his life suggests that.
He's definitely not that, but he's canny in certain ways that could lead to unfortunate futures for this country, even if he doesn't succeed on a large scale with any of his plans.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it sucks that he won, and it sucks that the Democrats were such a terrible party that they had so many millions of people stay home and offered nothing to the public. I mean, I completely agree. I guess, and I could be proven wrong in this. To me, the crisis of the age is the crisis of liberalism more than the crisis of the rise of a far right. I mean, just fundamentally, that's what I think is actually the problem facing.
They're completely related.
Yeah, but I think one is causally the source, and that's the crisis of liberalism. That is what I'm saying. And if you don't address that, you're not going to address any of the other things. And I'm just tired of the media not talking about what I personally consider to be the biggest crisis, which is that liberalism is unable to govern. It is unable to offer a positive program, and it is unable to get people to believe in it. That to me is pretty bad. And that could lead to terrible futures in the 10, 15, 20 years down the road, much more so than this like semi-nuts cult of personality who has managed to charismatically take over a political party, but who has also predictably been unable to designate a successor to carry this forward. I do not think J.D. Vance is that person personally. Time will tell. So it seems to me no one is willing to address the actual thing happening, which is liberalism has just totally collapsed in every way, shape, or form, basically.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but I would say I think there's more soul-searching of somewhat of that kind going on in the Democratic Party than there was last time around. I mean, they're obviously not going to put it the way you would
Maybe we could talk about that on the other side of a paywall.
On the other side of a paywall. Yeah. So this is, I was waiting for a leftist to bring up the importance of extracting money.
Yes.
From people who can barely afford capitalists.
What? Leftists are the best capitalists because we have no illusions about the system. No one's friends. This is all about extraction, baby. That's why the left is always, they're always the best capitalists.
Are they transactional? That's an overused term. We're all transactional, folks. Just quit using it as an accusation. Okay. So paywall, here's the way this works. So people who already have the good fortune of being paid subscribers to American Prestige or Non-Zero can see and or hear the rest of this. And if they haven't done it yet, set up a podcast that will allow them to always enjoy the bonus content, the podcast feed. And there's also this 20% discount thing, an amazing deal. So like, if you are a paid subscriber to my newsletter, you can go to the post where you get like the paid version of this and you will see a link to a place you can get a 20% discount on a subscription to American Prestige and vice versa. Assuming you guys remember to put the link in, which I, of course, encourage, you can go to the, if you're a paid subscriber to them, you get this mind-blowing discount. As a non-zero member, as we put, I've been told to call them members.
We just call them personal friends.
Yeah, close personal friends, even relatives if they're at the upper tier. Yeah.
But seriously, we're both good causes. This is not transactional. Yeah.
Let's catch some of those
people.
This is
the one good use, legitimate use of that word. Okay, yeah. So we're going into overtime. Thanks, everybody. Hope to see you there.